You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM. The Sound Poetry is brought today with Rick Clark reading. My name is David Gilmore. I'll be conducting the interview. Bug-Eyed and Bird-Brained, Small Creature Haiku, is a book that's illustrated with some sumi work by Fukio Kimura. Look for that one. Red Moon Press published it. Thanks for being here again, Rick. I'm looking forward to your reading some haiku to get us going into that mood of the image and the moment. And then we'll hear some narrative.
I really enjoyed our last sessions. I feel like this is just more fun.
Why don't we begin to stitch a few wingtips?
This one goes like this. Wingtips stitching the glassy cove, a scoter whistles away. Scoters are seabirds that make holes in cliffs, dirt cliffs usually. We call them loony birds because they were a little goofy. They flew very quickly along the surface of the water until they suddenly had to rise up to their cliff. The word stitching and the word whistles. What we have here is a thing called synesthesia. Synesthesia is when we combine senses, two, three, four senses possibly in a single image or coupling of images. Stitching is a visual matter, and then whistles is a sound. And very often when you heard them going by, you'd hear this kind of whistling. So synesthesia is something that I think that this poem does.
The next one, then, in a cloudy window.
One of the most common techniques in the haiku, the traditional haiku, the haiku that has the kireji, the cutting word or punctuation in English, is juxtaposition. Very often, haiku poets will take advantage of that cut or that cutting word or punctuation to juxtapose images or an image and an idea. This haiku does that, I think, fairly effectively. It goes like this. In a cloudy window, a homeless man strokes a long white beard. Now, I think the basic juxtaposition there is cloudy and white beard. It's playing with two images and that are similar in some ways. I've seen clouds that look like beards, and I've seen beards that look like clouds. So I think I was on public transportation and I saw this man doing this. I also think the haiku suggests that he's out in the weather. He's kind of one with the clouds, like ancient Chinese poets, for example.
Right. Yes, that might have been different if you had said a clouded window. The clouded would not have given us the image of the cloud as much, but the white also, I think, reflects back, as white often does, to the fact that we should imagine a cloud in the frame of the window in which the person is perhaps seated, the homeless man seated.
That poem was published in an anthology produced by Robert Epstein called All the Way Home, Aging in Haiku, in 2019. He lives in San Francisco.
Continuing with the aging, I read this one several times over the last few days, came across it. I think Fellini does an excellent job with voices, especially of old people, showing the raspiness and so on. That one I really think is quite wonderful, especially it's a springtime too.
I have been to Sicily many times. My wife, Fran Gallo, her family is from Sicily, the older women in particular, more than the men, have the almost a buzzing in their voice. There's a famous Basho poem that goes like this: deep silence, the buzz of the cicada drilling into stone. That's my translation. It's been translated hundreds of times. My poem harks back to that famous poem, and that, well, I'm kind of happy that I captured this. And by the way, I dedicate it to my wife and her sisters. Sicilian spring, old women's voices drilling ancient stone.
It goes very well with going back to another civilization, right? Voices. Now, we still have voices, but we don't so much hear the voices, but they're talking voices. And it's about older folk to the retired men, right?
Yes. I have been a regular visitor of Green Lake since about 1993. My wife and I now live very close to Green Lake. I couldn't help but associate the lake with their discussion of plumbing. In fact, it may be that the lake inspired them to have that conversation. The retired men sitting beside Green Lake, talking plumbing.
Talking plumbing, that does range over a number of topics. You know the term organ recital, when older folk get together. They talk about their bodies, the bodies breaking down. When I've gone to a coffee clatch with some old guys, often the thing comes up about what surgeries they've had lately. And very often it has to do with their plumbing.
Actually, I think it does resonate that way very well.
Now, you've got a few more here. Now, these are animal, maybe a senru with the mother poem, as the doe licks.
Spent a lot of time outside the house or even inside the house watching what was going on out there with the birds and the animals and the weather and the vegetation. And we had deer around the house almost all the time. Sometimes there would be a couple mothers with a two pair of fawns. This image really struck me because it's the only time I saw it happen. It goes like this. As the doe licks her fawn's neck, the fawn licks her mother's neck. This is something unusual in a haiku, I think. I have not really seen it done, but I would call it telescoping because I feel like the poem telescopes down from the mother down to the infant. And also the image is repeated, which is kind of unusual. The licking of the neck is in the poem twice.
That's right. It has a circularity to it. You can almost imagine an iconic image of the two, one licking the other, both licking one another. These poems in this section with the mother poem you're going to read, these are celebrating motherhood in many respects. This second one makes me almost chuckle.
My siblings and I have been having sibling retreats ever since our mother died in 2011. This was the retreat that we had right before COVID. So that would have been November 2019, around our mother's birthday. We were having an art session, which is something we do in our family, whatever, painting, sketching, writing a haiku, playing some music, and usually we do it all at the same time. This haiku happened. We were at my brother's cabin out on the Long Branch Peninsula. He's got a view of Mount Rainier over the water, and it goes like this. Misty Mount Rainier, our mother still making us paint pictures. The reason I chose this haiku is because of what is called in poetry, lined poetry, enjambment, meaning where the line breaks, it breaks across the grammatical structure. And you think that the line is kind of done in this case. Our mother still making us paint pictures is on the next line. I'd call it a surprise enjambment.
And it gets punctuated by the P's to the last line, the painting picture. A lot of sharp plosives there, right? Yeah. There's a misty Mount Rainier. I can imagine kids, for example, saying, but the mountain isn't there. It's just a mist. It's a cloud. And she said, paint it. Paint it anyway.
That's what we were doing, actually. We were painting or writing about the mountain. My mother was quite a good painter. She wanted to do art way back when she was young and was sent off to finishing school. She pursued art at UPS, University of Puget Sound. She still is making us. She's still alive. She's still with us. She's still in us. She's making us do things, but particularly paint pictures.
Now, would you like to turn to perhaps your father's haiku, the dad death haiku?
My father, Bob Boxberger, died last year in January. It came pretty quickly. We didn't expect it to happen. In fact, we had him convinced he was going to live to be 100 years old. But that didn't happen. I was the one person who was available to drive down to California to be there. He died about 6 hours after I arrived, and I was sleeping on the floor beside his gurney bed. And then when I realized he wasn't breathing anymore, I called his companion, Anne. We determined that he was gone. She called the nurse to come and confirm that he was dead. Then Anne suddenly, abruptly said, "Shall we have some wine?" It was probably about 1:30 in the morning, maybe 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, "Hey, why not?" We got the wine out and sat down at the table while we were waiting for the people to come and, the Neptune Society to come and pick up his body. She told me the story that they didn't drink at all because Dad had told her that he was an alcoholic. And my eyes just about popped when she said that, because my dad was not an alcoholic. He was very careful not to drink a lot. Occasionally you get a little tipsy now and then, but if he and my mother found themselves drinking 2 glasses of wine a night, they quit. That was too much. And in fact, I don't think he was really drinking much when he met his new companion, Anne. And he lied to her and said that he was an alcoholic, but he had quit. After his death, the cork snapped off the off-bounds wine.
And you call it an off-bounds wine. Is that a term that's used of wines?
No, but the wine was off-bounds to either of them because she decided that since he wasn't going to drink, then she wouldn't drink. And therefore, the wine was off-bounds to the both of them.
So it really does connect in that way rather than have some wine connection. Yeah. Very good. It was an interesting twist on the snapped off and the off balance. Yeah. Right. So now, in conclusion of some of the haiku, let's do the haiga that you have here.
Yes.
And also the local ren, which is not particularly haiga, but the two of them being bird imagery will be a naturalistic conclusion.
The local wren building her nest up inside the rusty heron. Out at Ocean Shores, Fran and I had a metal sculpture of a heron that had been made in Africa, and it was quite attractive. Unfortunately, the weather out there was really rough on stuff, and that heron was rusting, and after a while, it actually started falling apart. But meanwhile, our local wren had found a hole up where the breastplate met the neck, where it was welded. There was a perfect hole there, and she made a nest inside there, and she went to work and pushed every bit of that nest out of that metal heron. And I watched the whole thing, and it was a good moment for me.
Silent Tawn.
Yes.
A haiga.
A haiga. In English, we spell it H-A-I-G-A, haiga, is a haiku and a picture combined. But it was quite a tradition in Japan to have a haiku inked or painted or brushed onto a picture. There is a painter who lives in Romania. He's from Romania. His name is Ian Cădrescu, and he made a book called The Wanderer Brush. He asked me if I'd like to submit some haiku, and he asked a lot of other people from around the world, actually. He chose one of mine, but the poem goes like this. Silent Tarn. Worm trails crisscross mountain faces. Actually, I've seen something like this a few times when I've been hiking up in the mountains. And actually, you can see it probably in lakes and in the sea as well, where there's mud and there are little trails from small creatures having crossed. In this case, my brother and I and maybe some friends hiked up to some lakes in the North Cascades, and there's this point where you reach the highest place where you've been climbing and scrambling to get there, and then from there heading down, and there's this tarn that's the size of a classic pond, and it's fairly shallow and it's perfectly clear. And I was standing there looking down into the tarn, and I saw this image. And finally, I wrote it down, and Ian Cădrescu liked it. I succeeded in this haiku to make a pure nature haiku.
What's interesting about your choice of the kind of tarn, the body of water, and the mountain faces, as I see in the image that Cădrescu painted, there is a smoothness to the mountain faces, because these are generally glacial lakes and ponds, right? The tarn. Scandinavia's full of tarns.
Yeah.
We don't often come across that term as a pond or a lake in normal discourse anymore.
If you're a hiker or a backpacker or a mountain climber, these words are probably more common.
Well, could we go on to your longer poetry now? Here you have written a number of poems that they seem to be fairly current works that you're going to be reading. And The Head of Wind is the first one I suggested, because we're going to go perhaps to your seashore abode. That one I think would be a great one. We'll get on a head of wind here.
I was lying in our bedroom. I think it was the bedroom, lying there listening to this storm. Yeah, and Ocean Shores near the sea. Head of wind. A storm gust knocks hard on my bedroom window. With its heavy fist jolts the whole rock-solid house, then bolts around the corner, charges out over the woods, tousling heads of myrtles, jostling the spruce's arms, with one great whoosh, swerves out of earshot, a head of steam, a ball of fire, an icy comet with terrifying face, bulging bloodshot eyes, and leering teeth. And I, in my box of light, flail about for my pen, having survived 50 years of history's storms, and at the storm's bidding, take careful notes.
We are imagining the storm as a creature of sorts, that you have a competition, or actually you want to capture it in your writing. And you have done that with the music and rhythm of its force. We'll go from there to actual, well, I don't know if they could be called real ones if they're gnomic, but the gnomic frogs, maybe the frogs have gnosis about them.
Gnomic frogs. And this is for Frogman Brent, who is a biologist in Vancouver and a lifelong friend. He's known as the Frogman by his friends and his colleagues because he specializes in amphibians. Tree frogs are creaking out in the dark cave of night, in the hollow of the ocean's roar, beyond my open window. Where do they live during the day? For hours I've studied the moss growing on the forest's trunks and never spied a green tree frog. Can I blame them for being so completely themselves, for embracing night so wholeheartedly, when it's during the day we people clamor so loudly? Were there only such a frog as could sing a few appreciative lines about the bubble of light in which I dwell, high up in my room above the wood? How I exclaim myself with my pen, how such human attentiveness must be worthy of mention in the annals of the frogs, but who seem only to say, prayers are best not answered, silence is the soundest reply.
And that one is also quite recent, December of 2014. Yeah, but you got it. Prayers are best not answered. Silence, the soundest reply in the face of the sound of frogs and the awareness of the frog with its big bug eyes, part of the title of your collection. Fallen leaves now, the quiet, something quiet here, but very much still alive.
This was during a time of war. I am a Vietnam veteran, and so I wrote this poem with that context, that general attitude. It's called Fallen Leaves in a Time of War. So beautiful where you lie, dead and dying on the ground, decorating our landscape, our mounds, for the posterity of our eyes, blonde and chocolate brown, gold, copper, silver, and bronze, blood red and adolescent green, belly up white with fear. How lovely you are in your profusion, your slow death throes, as you turn brittle then to mush under winter's endless rain. What excellent rations you'll make for worms and moles, those relentless armored bugs. Fallen leaves, I feel this much love.
The whole metaphor of leaves and human bodies is apparent there, and a very profound comparison that you make with just hints of what you can imagine of the human loss, of the human body in decay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fallen leaves, yeah, in a time of war.
Yes.
So we're dealing with a compass.
But sadly.
Gruesome.
It is.
Well, to a lighter subject, how we relate to birds, how we attend to them and their names.
I didn't want it to sound sing-songy. I wanted the lines to keep pushing forward to the next line so that you could hear them. They would chime a little bit, but not too much. And this poem is called Bird Identification. Seemed like a year we tried to name you, whose pale yellow rear flashed as you flew. Warbler, we all corroborated, but Myrtle, yellow-rumped or Audubon, we long debated, flipping through the pages on and on. How did we get so confused on the path to knowledge? How did one small bird I'm used to seeing in the trees above the sedge make us flit so busily around the morning table, peering through glasses dizzily just to tag you with a label? With what simple delight we were completely baffled as you who live and sing in flight without a name flew on, unruffled.
I don't know how you feel about the effort that goes into doing a formal piece with the rhyme that you have to think about as you come to that verse, but I just often wonder. Lots of poems we write are difficult to write, even though they don't have these formal features that we have to squeeze the verse into. And yet, one like this makes me think, how long was it before you decided unruffled is, that's quite all right. Baffled, that's a close rhyme. And that's good. That's good enough, right?
Yeah. There's a category of rhymes. They're called slant rhymes, half rhymes. It kind of opens the world up a little bit more for the poet and helps him relax. So,
yeah, it's interesting how we play with sounds, and that the music is sometimes there in the very word that you have to use to name the thing. Crabapple tree, you had this one printed. This was published in Spindrift, which is a fairly local journal, right?
Yes, it's the Shoreline Art and Literary Journal. It's been around for years and years, and it's a beautiful book.
Mm-hmm.
I think it comes out maybe once a quarter or once a year, maybe, and collects a lot of poems, mostly from people in this region.
Yeah, Spindrift. Think of that if you're a Northwest poet for submitting a poem periodically. See if you can get in there. Crabapple tree is one that fits in the Northwest too. We are familiar with these little fruits that seem to go to waste most of the time, but not to waste if you're a bird.
Crabapple tree. Beyond the golden opportunity tarnished by jadedness, beyond the comforting squabble that is the great chicken coop of this world, you stand like a testament to pure, unadulterated existence, not as simple as the stone at your feet, nor as complex as the crow who topples, reaching with her beak for one of your tiny, overripe apples. I could cut you down, cut you up into firewood. I could shape you into an image I have in mind. Yet you expect nothing of me. You take everything I do to you with chainsaw and loppers, and yet you do not move, while I need endure nothing of you except your incremental growth. I make metaphors of your crusty bark. I turn you into syllables. I go so far as to abandon myself spiritually to your grace. Yet there you stand, rooted so profoundly, I can't imagine such rootedness. My body is so insane to move, and only for a moment can I follow your example, and only superficially at that. I might imagine I might be so vain, so egocentric, as to believe you love me in some inhuman way, but I already take so much from your stillness and strength, from the slow flow of your colors through the seasons, that I do my best not to turn you into a man. Grateful that if you cannot love, then you cannot hate me.
Twists and turns that you have in there to metaphorize and metamorphose self and tree is kind of interesting. It's quite a play that's going on there, mind and nature. The curse of parents.
Okay, the curse of parents speaks for itself. I have my mother's cough, a strong, healthy cough, but my mother's cough just the same. It's disconcerting late at night when, as I cough, I hear my mother cough on the far side of the mountain. And though I fight the impulse, I collect books as my father does. They creep up along the walls and around the corners of my room till books surround me with their wrinkled bindings and sideways cryptic titles. The books gather dust that makes me cough, and the coughing makes me buy more books to bank up against the dust.
How about some of these other poems of your dad, like My Father's Splitting Wood?
Yeah, I don't have that in the folder.
Hiking with your dad, you went to the Himalayas?
Yes.
For a hike with him? A hike up to a mystic lake in Mount Rainier Park.
My dad and I went for a walk, and this is what happened. The poem is called Father, Son, Bear, and it took place at Mystic Lake on Mount Rainier, August 1994. The bear trundled out of the woods as my father and I sat beside the lake, emptied its bowels by the water's edge, then splashed into the lake up to its neck, slurping through the corners of its mouth. It turned back up the bank, shook the water dripping from its sides till a rainbow shone in the bright mountain air above its head, then ambled over to a nearby cedar tree, rose up on its hinds, and began raking bark with its long curved claws. After this ritual, the bear sank down beside the tree and fell asleep at its foot. All the while, we sat there, muffling exclamations of astonishment. We couldn't believe our eyes. Who in a lifetime could ever expect to see such a spectacle? It occurred to me we were the only pair of fathers and sons in all the world who had ever seen a bear shit in the woods, gurgle water in a lake, conjure a rainbow out of thin air, scratch bark, and take a nap, all in a matter of 5 timeless minutes. Not even in Wild Kingdom have I seen such a wild performance. Not even in a movie or a novel or the tallest tale told by the biggest liar in the universe have I seen or heard of such an exclusive act, let alone with my one and only father.
An amazing thing. No wonder you are muffled in your exclamations. Don't want to cause too much attention at that point, do you? In the building of your place down on ocean shores, you and your father had a terrible accident that could have been much more disastrous than it turned out. Yeah. How about reading that one?
Okay. With floor on it, was over 4 feet, and he dove out of that window down into the sand at 59 years old. And meanwhile, I just kind of danced in my window. I really had no way to dive. I just kind of danced it out until I released it a little bit and the bass came down onto the floor. So I wrote a poem about that moment. Father, son, wall. Let a son and father be on the same side of a wall. especially when they tilt it up. Let them crank the wall jacks simultaneously. And if a ton of wood swings out precariously and they have to dance madly in windows orbiting around their knees, then may they, in their filial way, dance madly together all at once or dive free of the foundation. Let them strap the foot of the wall to solid floor so nothing on or between them falls.
It is kind of amazing that you both got out of that one without some terrible scratch or a nail puncture. Is there another one that you would like to choose yourself for a concluding poem?
First razor. It hides behind the scent dispenser, the stack of toilet paper rolls, the plunger and the scrubber in the cabinet beneath the sink, waiting to prove the boy a man. Does a razor make a man? Will it scrape away boyhood as a mower mows wispy grass? Will it turn the skin to hide? For days, the razor waits, then gets its chance again to draw out a little color and bristle, a little blood from a baby face. The razor hides from the father, the accuser, the defender, the judge, in the crimes of premature masculinity. One razor, no refills, dull to the task. The sheer physicality of its presence remains something of a miracle. It hides well, being a small assumption in size and shape, almost feminine to look at in spite of the engineers of masculinity. It's got a head, one stiff, knurled leg, and it'll prove the unwitting father wrong before he discovers it and upbraids the boy's great pretensions. The father, who shaves with a bar of soap, a brush and cup, as he did during the war, stationed in the Aleutians, who in another era committed the crime of coming of age.
Life goes on, and yet what you have done in this one, you've personified the razor. The razor does a lot of the work, the hiding, and yet, of course, you are the agent casting the actions, the behavior onto the razor. So it's not me, really. It's the razor's begging. The razor's begging me to do this. Many ways to think about your own work, poets and listeners, to write haikus or poems about your life, memorializing parents, and thinking of some of the joyful and humorous times and not always the grim times. Poetry helps to relieve some of that gloom. Thank you very much, Rick. It was wonderful having you for Sound Poetry.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed this so much.
This is Sound Poetry. I've been your host, David Gilmore, with Rick Clark, Seattle poet, retired teacher, writer of prose and poetry, but now famous as a haiku artist. Thank you.